Welcome to our first episode. Does archival authenticity matter? Some of you may have heard of this word authentic or authenticity that's been percolating in the fashion industry for a while now. But one thing that's also happening in the fashion industry is that we increasingly see authenticity tied to an archive. You might have seen archival drops come to your inbox. You might have seen a direct from the archive in your Instagram as you scroll. So what exactly does authenticity mean? And what does authenticity as tied to an archive do? Do archival designs increase a fashion brand's market share? Are archival designs more authentic than other newer designs for consumers? And what challenges and opportunities do archival designs present for brands' trademarks, their protection, and their scope? So these are just some of the questions that we're going to be exploring on this episode, but so much more. So these questions might seem theoretical when I say them, so it's always helpful to have an example. Some of you might have watched Sabato De Sarno's recent debut for Gucci. And of course, you might have seen this Ancona Red, which is very prevalent in his collection. One thing that's also prevalent in the Gucci collection by Sabato De Sarno is the reuse of designs that are really indicative of Gucci. So the Jackie bag, for example. The green, red, green stripe that's now reimagined with this Ancora red. So we see designers take from the archive and include these archival designs and pieces as part of new runway collections. So that's what we're talking about on this episode. Are those types of designs authentic? How do designers do that? How do they cite to the archive? And what does that mean from a legal perspective? Does that help your legal rights or not? So before we delve into all the details, I thought I would talk to Sarah Mae Ettinger, who's the founder and creative director of MADE, a New York City luxury brand. Sarah's an emerging designer, and I'm happy to say that I met her many years ago because her sister and I attended law school together, which was wonderful. And so I was happy to reconnect with her and talk to her, and especially about archives and May and how she's evolving her brand. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your brand and your journey as an American luxury designer with her emerging brand. I'm so grateful.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So to start out, tell us a little bit about your brand May and how you conceived of it and how you started out and your life as a designer in New York City and in the American fashion industry.
Absolutely. You know, it's so funny. I feel like from the outside, it probably seems like living the like American designer dream, living in New York City and designing and having an atelier here and doing production. And in a lot of ways, if I think about, you know, where I was when I was a kid wanting to be a designer, I think like I wouldn't believe where I am now. But it has been a real journey to get here, to say the least, as I'm sure many, many designers could also attest. So my background is obviously in design. I've been a designer basically my whole life. I think around the time I was 8, I decided I was going to be a fashion designer, and my parents were absolutely terrified and promptly told me to go to a 4-year university. I was very fortunate. My high school actually had a fashion program, so that's really how I got my start. And then going into college, I went to Washington University in St. Louis, where I also studied design, but then very quickly started studying in New York every summer with a different design house. So I was with Marquesa and then Michael Kors Runway and then with Kate Spade, where I ultimately, you know, got my start. And I like to kind of say I grew up at Kate Spade. I learned everything I know there. And I loved every second that I was there. It definitely has had a very big impact on me personally and professionally. I get, you know, it's funny when people see my work now, they're like, oh, I get it. Like I can see the Kate Spade influence. And I find it actually very refreshing that I've been able to kind of like take it with me and evolve it into my own style. But, you know, in 2020, obviously the world was in a very different place than it was when I was growing up at Kate Spade. I was there for 6.5 years. And in June of 2020, COVID was in full force. And unfortunately, there were about 100 women that were laid off from Kate Spade in a single day. It was pretty awful. And I did not see it coming. At the time, I was working as senior designer for Outlet, and we were doing really well. We were doing full Outlet collections. I had a very strong understanding of the heritage Kate Spade girl, and that's really what we were imbuing into the Outlet brand. And I thought everything was going real well, and COVID had other plans. And in June of 2020, I was laid off from Kate. And I ate a lot of ice cream for a while. At that point, I was really trying to figure out what I wanted. And that's really where the sustainable fashion and the concept around my aversion to overproduction really had started. I think I didn't quite even know how much I was struggling with being in corporate fashion. When we were in Outlet, we were doing thousands of units of pieces, and it's hard to imagine that you're creating like hundreds of something or 1,000 of something. It just kind of blows your mind that many of one thing could exist. And it really takes the relationship to the product away, in the same mindset that, you know, what I've put into May, and I'll explain more in a minute, but I care so much about every single piece and the detail. And when you're creating at such a level of production, you really just, you have to kind of desensitize yourself from that. You can't care about each piece. It really just, you only see dollars. and so when I left corporate, I was really kind of struggling with that dissonance, and trying to decide if I wanted to go back into corporate fashion. Even, you know, when I started May, I really was still applying to jobs, trying to figure out what my plan was. And every company I applied to, you know, I applied to, I think back, I think I applied to Gap. I applied to J. Crew, like brands that everyone knows, but are doing the same thing in terms of the type of production. And I couldn't find anywhere that was, you know, assessing production in the way that I wanted to. And so I decided to do it myself.
Tell me a little bit more about your codes at May, or, you know, the parts of your design aesthetic. So, you know, from a legal standpoint, what always fascinates me is the way that we leave some designs and some color codes really as building blocks in fashion. So you talk about the heritage of Kate Spade and then using that, you know, in your own line, but then tweaking it, obviously. I mean, that's something that the law really can facilitate and allow, right? When you think about the negative spaces of IP law. So tell us more a little bit about, you know, your designs, you use the bow, you're wearing a bow today. Okay. Fabulous. So tell us a little bit more about those design codes and aesthetics and your commitment to sustainability. So,
you know, when I was starting May, I had very little money or capital. I emptied my savings account. I did all of the initial branding myself, on Illustrator. I had no input from anyone, and I just knew that I wanted it to be pink, which, you know, is very core to my DNA. And as the brand evolved, I started realizing that I needed to have brand codes that were a little bit more sophisticated and a little bit broader. Like I had only singled in on one color. And as I grew the brand over the past 3 years, I had time finally to sit down and really think about for the first time. I launched the brand in 6 months. I feel like I didn't really have the headspace and the ability to really think through what I wanted the branding to look like. So it was, you know, I always knew I was going to end up evolving it pretty quickly. And this year, actually, I finally was able to. And when I did evolve the brand codes, a big piece of it was wanting to keep the playfulness of the brand, to find a way to incorporate the bow that wasn't quite so literal. We actually, when we were doing the branding, we sketched over 100 different bows, and not a single one of them felt right for the brand. Which is so funny because it is such an icon for me, but I couldn't I didn't find a way, and maybe I will one day. I think that's the beauty of evolving your brand. Maybe I'll find a way someday to, you know, put that back into our brand codes in a graphic way. But for right now, you know, that didn't quite stand out to me. What did stand out to me was the color. And to your point, like I really did pull on my heritage as a Kate Spade designer out of the 1960s. I love 1950s and 60s. I genuinely believe I was born in the wrong era. even further back, one particular inspiration that's always been very present for me is Elsa Schiaparelli. She was very popular in the 1930s. She's probably my biggest design crush. She actually invented a color called Shocking Pink. So yes. When I was building out my palette, that was something I was really keeping in mind. I kind of wanted to pay a homage to her, an homage to her, of incorporating what the May pink would be. And so we actually brightened the palette from what the initial pink was and then kind of added in these tones of the 1960s, like a little bit groovy, a little bit funky. And then, you know, finding a little bit more of like a chartreusey green than the Kate Spade. I mean, Kate Spade green is iconic. It is its own world. But I knew that, you know, I wanted to pay a little bit of homage to that, as I was building out the palette.
Do you archive as you go through these different brand evolutions and as you design? You know, one of the things we're focusing on as part of this conversation is the notion of archival authenticity. So, and I'd be very curious to know if you archive, especially since you're, you know, a young brand, but you already have gone through so many changes and have such a vision and have tweaked your vision, but also what you think is of as authentic when you think of May.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I am so young still in the brand. The brand is young. And I also will point out that I do live in New York City. So the archival space is quite limited. But I did, my factory made me promise, you know, I'm very close with my factory. My studio is on 40th Street and my factory is on 36th Street. So I'm in my factory every single day with my production team, with my seamstresses, with my cutters. And they made me promise I would keep one piece of each style that we make. The truth is, like, you know, the archives that exist, a lot of times, like I remember when I was in school in St. Louis, there was an archive, gorgeous archive there of a lot of the vintage pieces from the 1920s and 30s of these very well-to-do women in St. Louis. And a lot of what the, you know, these designers that were in St. Louis at the time, a lot of them were like amazing seamstresses that had started small collections. We only have archives of them from the well-to-do women who have since donated their clothing, or they passed away and their clothing was donated. So thinking about it, you know, from like a designer perspective, you know, they're kind of like my babies. Like my relationship with them is so different than my relationship at Kate Spade was with my pieces. You know, a big part, people always think this is funny, but I always refer to my clothing as she, and I name them all specifically. And a big piece of that is because I want people to actually think of them as people, I guess, in a way. Like I want people to have an emotional connection with them. You have a relationship with that person or that thing, or you think about it in a way that is more meaningful than just disposing of it. And that's a big piece of the sustainability as well.
Yes, all fashion lawyers on the call who wish that designers had some sort of moral rights or protections like artists are probably silently cheering now as they listen to you describe, you know, your relationship with your designs and with the tangible iterations of them, which, you know, makes not only makes total sense, but is such a great view into your own vision and feelings as a designer too. So on that note of what you've designed, I have to say, I just fell in love with your Scalamandre collection. I thought I'm a huge animal print person. And so I saw the zebras and I thought, oh, this is so great aesthetically. And then I started doing some more, you know, nerdy research on your website and into Scalamandre. And I had no idea that they were such a hugely historically important manufacturer of fabrics, and also that there was an Italian connection too.
My collaboration with Scalamandre has been one of the most exciting things I've done with May so far. It was a little bit of a crazy scenario of how it all came to be. I was in Charleston at a trunk show I'm gonna say like a year and a half ago. And in wandered this adorable, amazing woman named Laurel. And it turned out that she was in communications, head of communications for Scalamandre. She fell in love with the line. I learned later she'd actually seen us on Instagram before. And she and I have just totally hit it off. We're very good friends now. And within a few months, she had me in their offices. I had met their design director and I had pitched them on creating a May X Scalamandre collection. You know, they have done collaborations with other brands, but never clothing, which was a huge opportunity for me to be the first ever apparel collaboration for them to be able to do it in such a way that was in line with the quality of their fabrics. And then at the same time, as we started the research process of what those fabrics would look like, we realized that we actually had the exact same Italian mill creating our fabrics. It was
pinch me moment, destiny was meant to be.
I could not believe it. There's a mill in Italy that I had been working with since I started, that I had just always adored. Their fabrics are unbelievable. They work with every major, you know, European incredible brand across the country and world, in both home goods and in the fashion space, apparel space. So it was like truly kismet. Actually, once we realized that there was no like approval process because we just trusted everyone. So I basically submitted to Scalamandre. I was like, this is the quality that I've run with Clarici before. This is what I want to do. I want to do it in this silhouette. And they were like, cool, go for it. and it, you know, we sold out the first round, which was insane. We just did our jumping zebras in olive as well for the holiday, although it'll look so good in the spring, back to khaki, just saying. And we have a lot of really fun plans coming up in the spring and next year. So you can definitely expect this to be an ongoing collaboration for us. And you know, it was the last thing I'll say is it was just such a full circle moment for me. I remember one of my first days at Kate Spade, I walked into a conference room, and they had the zebra wallpaper. I was an intern at the time and I was like, what's that? Like, oh my God, this is so cool. Is this a Kate Spade print? And I was like, I didn't realize. And then I started doing the research and I've always loved it. And so when I got approached to do this, it was just like, wow, what, like, everything coming together.
It's amazing to me how your aesthetic of 1960s, I mean, I see a lot of, you know, Mad Men when I look at your clothes, you know, and it's amazing how that iconic print, that's how they describe it, you know, on their website, matches your aesthetic so well. So, you know, from what you've just said, I hear authenticity both in terms of the mill you use and your processes, but also just this idea of design aesthetics too coming together.
Really, you know, I didn't even realize it quite as much until I saw it in garment form. But earlier that year, before Scalamandre and I started talking, I had actually been working with an artist of mine who's done many prints for me. She's amazing. And she had been working on what we call a conversational print or a novelty print, which is very popular in my world at Kate Spade. You know, it had always been part of my conversation as a designer to have these very whimsical prints that are usually animal-based or conversational, right? They start a conversation. And she had been working on a print for me, many prints actually, trying to land what that looked like for May. And I had rejected so many of them. I just couldn't land on what felt authentic to May. Everything felt too young or too juvenile. It wasn't speaking the right language. It didn't feel like in the aesthetic conversation. And then when Scalamandre approached me, I was like, oh my God, this is it. I don't need my own novelty or conversational prints because this is the relationship that I've been looking for because I want it to be seated in something historic. And it was originally actually in an Italian restaurant in New York City in the 1950s called Gino's on the East Side. It has since closed, but every time I see it, I always have women who come up to me. They're like, I used to eat there. and it's also been used in the Royal Tenenbaums, this Wes Anderson movie, which is so amazing. So it definitely has a lot of history, which feels also like so authentic to New York City as a brand that is obsessed with New York City. You know, that also just felt like such an amazing collaboration.
Right. No, it's great. So everyone go check it out on the May. What are some of the challenges you faced as an emerging designer? I mean, like even for your collab with Scalamandre, I mean, I can imagine you had agreements, right, as part of that collab, and obviously don't reveal anything confidential, but just especially since, you know, lawyers, we really kind of like to have a knowledge of what more can we do, right? For designers, what more, especially for emerging designers who, you know, frankly, as you said, you drained your savings, you know, don't have all the capital, you know, aren't backed, aren't an LVMH backed brand. Although in my opinion, a conglomerate will probably be interested in you in the future. in your brand. So, but Justin, I mean, what are some of the challenges you faced and how do you, I mean, what resources do you wish you had more of or that you still would need?
You know, it's funny. I think from a legal perspective, I was very fortunate. As you know, my sister, I come from a family of lawyers, so I definitely had support that way in like a very general sense. There were so many questions I had when I was setting up the business, and I would have done anything for that process to have been streamlined for me, like setting up an LLC. Should I be an S-Corp? Should I be an LLC? Like what is that process? So I definitely think if there would have been something for me to like follow, a guidebook, anything. Because when you're starting a brand, I mean, there is zero support. People are emotionally supportive. People want to be there for you. They want to purchase things. But like when it comes to the back ends, like no one has any idea. Speaking now, like back to myself, I would have been like, figure out how to hire someone, because that was the messiest part of the whole business, was actually doing the setup. But then also, you know, we talk a little bit more about, I know you're looking at things from an IP perspective as well. When I was at Kate Spade, we had this really funny meeting that would happen every 6 months or so, and they called it legal training. And we would all sit in a room, and there would be a lawyer there who would show us a slideshow of examples of cases of copying that went to court or didn't go to court, or why something could be copied or not copied. And there was like very famous cases in there. One was like the Gucci stripe that had been copied and had gone to court. And there had been this myth that I have no idea who made it up, but it is definitely not true, that if you as a designer change something 7 times, that like 7 was the number, that it therefore was no longer a copy.
Oh yeah, I've heard 3. I've never heard 7 before. I've heard 3, and every time I'm like, I remember your sister and I talking about this when we were in law school. Like, that is not. Did you let? No, I did not. That was not in the case we read.
Yeah, so, not a thing. And I think, you know, as a young designer, what's really hard is, well, a couple of things. One, the corporate fashion world, not Kate Spade necessarily, any fairly fast fashion in the terms of like Zara, but also brands like J. Crew and Gap, and, you know, not throwing anyone under the bus, but like the world of corporate fashion is very much built on doing what everyone else is doing and making it accessible at different price points. And so, you know, when you're building that as your world of fashion, everyone is just knocking everyone off. And, you know, to say there is a world in which designers, and I do it too, everyone does it, where we look at something, we're inspired by it, and we build on it, right? But building on something and copying it are two very different things. And so one of the biggest things I saw coming out of corporate fashion is that, you know, I wanted to move away from this world of super trendy, super copying. You know, what is this runway person doing? How do we dumb it down? How do we do it produced not in Italy? How do we, you know, I used to sit through costing meetings where they'd be like, you can only have 4 buttons. And I'm like, but I need 5 buttons or it won't close. And they're like, but you can't afford 5 buttons. And I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? They're like, use 4 buttons. And so, you know, I think I really wanted to just rewrite the conversation when it came to that. And I felt that I had a different perspective to share in terms of design. I mean, we are not a trendy brand. I've had people tell us that I am not for cool girls.
Photo shoots really belie the fact that you're not for cool girls. I mean, anyone who has seen even your opening shot with, you know, the woman in the bow dress pouring champagne is, I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's cool, but you know, what do I know?
No, it's so funny. I just think that we are not mainstream. And I think that is what actually is really helping us to become successful so quickly. We've had incredible growth this year. And I think it's because we are finally approaching something. We are approaching fashion. We are approaching design and our aesthetic in a different way than the rest of the industry is.
That very much goes to this idea that, as I said before, you know, there are certain things even an IP that are not IP, that are in the public domain, that are part of a negative space of IP from which we all draw when we, you know, create, or rather when designers, you know, create fashion. I mean, I always give the example of the little black dress. So, you know, we all know Chanel has her version of the little black dress. But, you know, should we give someone a monopoly in the little black dress? Don't we all have, you know, a right? I mean, in here, I don't know, I'm getting a little, you know, rights oriented with the right to wear a little black dress. But, you know, I mean, it is true. I mean, we all should be able to also, you know, wear a bow, for example.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you mean, your perspective on that, I think, is really important, because it shows also how designers themselves realize that they are operating in this bigger space and want you to buy their clothes and want you to, you know, buy into the May language too, but also are very aware that, you know, we exist in a pluralistic aesthetic design society. And so we both communicate with each other based on those building blocks, but also then can certainly innovate.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said.
If you're listening in and you have not visited the May website, I urge you to. It's fun. It's great. And Sarah, it's been so much fun talking to you and learning more about your process. So thanks so much, really.
Yes, absolutely.
So one of the things that you might have picked up on in my conversation with Sarah is about how challenging emerging designers find navigating the legal space. Sarah and I talked about the myth of changing a design 7 times when really what that was referring to was, as many lawyers might, of course, know, substantial similarity in copyright, the test that's deployed to determine whether one pattern, for example, a work of authorship, is infringing another. And of course, trademark law is all about source, so consumer confusion, which is very different from just simply copying. So one thing that, of course, is so interesting about speaking to emerging designers like Sarah is to think about, you know, how exactly an archive can help a designer. What impact can it have if you do save all the patterns you use and have a very detailed organizational system? So to discover the benefits of having an archive, especially for intellectual property rights and their scope, I talked to Serena Totino, an attorney with K&L Gates.
An archive is definitely a valuable source of evidence from a legal perspective. So especially when we think about fashion as a fast-moving industry, having an archive to use for evidence gathering, it's a great advantage, both for clearance and enforcement purposes. So ideally, an archive should be digital and accessible so that both the legal and design team are comfortable using it. And we know that from a design perspective, designs might stand out for a specific feature or for a combination of feature. So being able to show that a brand used those elements in the past can be material to avoid litigation or to defend a case. So in practice, I agree in terms of considering both the brand archive and third parties archives as great resources, including universities, museums, foundations. So these are great tools for fashion houses, and they can assist the legal assessment risk process and help understanding what the infringement risk is. And it is important, especially when it comes to understanding trends. And therefore, if, for example, certain elements have been a trend in the past, or if they are a trend in the present times. So it is important to use those tools and also understand if certain elements can be considered to be specific to a certain designer or fashion house.
So, you know, you're a senior associate at K&L Gates London office, and you're currently pursuing a second min at K&L Gates Melbourne office, which is very exciting now in similar jurisdictions, but also, of course, you're Italian, so you know a lot about different jurisdictions. Could you share some foundational perspectives on what makes a great IP portfolio, especially for a fashion brand, and, you know, what you've said about all the different things that you might find in an archive, but also the different people that might own an archive, the different sources of evidence? You know, what are some of the challenges that fashion brands face when it comes to registering trademarks and thinking about the archive or otherwise managing their IP portfolio?
Sure, this is a great question. I would say that a well-constructed IP portfolio takes into account all the rights that a brand can possibly rely upon. No one right alone is sufficient to provide a comprehensive protection. So a brand cannot always predict what type of infringement it might face. And one or more IP rights may come into play according to the technicalities of each case. So it is important for a brand to consider both registered and unregistered rights. And it is important to prioritize which IP right to secure depending on the jurisdiction. So I think it is key to build a portfolio that protects different elements of the same product, including designs, trademarks, and unregistered design rights, including copyright. In terms of challenges, I think there are certain evergreen challenges that brand faces in the fashion industry, including, for example, registering and protecting a simple product. So simplicity, it is quite difficult to protect. And especially now that we see trends, including quiet luxury, I think it is important to be aware that it might be difficult to protect simple designs or simple brands, because under the law, it might be that design or trademark can be refused for lack of novelty or individual character in the case of a design, or also be refused for lack of distinctiveness in the case of a trademark. And more recently, I think challenges might arise from registering shape, position, and color marks, as consumers are not used to consider these elements as a badge of origin, or at least this is what the registry normally say in the case of registering what we call non-traditional marks. So there are some recent cases in this space, including the Birkenstock outsole, the Moon Boots, or the Cadbury Purple. These cases are all very interesting because they show how can be difficult to register non-traditional marks, even though these elements have been iconic for a certain brand.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much innovation that's happening. And what you mentioned about simple and quiet luxury versus, you know, the over the top logos you might be used to seeing is also fascinating, because it just shows how the law and creativity and thinking about, you know, what your brand might have done in the past and what a new creative director even wants to do is really, you know, in a cycle of, you know, communication with each other. So we might have the law affecting creative design and vice versa. And that brings me to thinking about creative directors and designers. So one of the things that we've seen a lot of creative directors and designers do who are new to a brand is dip into a brand's archives, you know, representing symbols that are in the brand's archive and maybe haven't been part of a product for years, you know, or adding to well-known marks. We even see brands that collaborate with each other. And I'm sure, you know, fashion lawyers listening in and others in the fashion industry can think of so many examples. So could you give us an overview from a legal perspective, you know, and I know that you have, I mean, already you've kind of given an overarching perspective of some of the challenges, but in terms really of trademarks, for example, you know, and distinctiveness, but also different jurisdictions. So I think of, you know, first to use versus first to file. And especially, you know, young designers might be thinking, okay, well, wait, how do I navigate that? You know, could you give us some insight into those areas too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is important to consider in a challenging space and in a continuous changing space that there are new things that can be protected now. And I mentioned before non-traditional trademarks. So what we can now protect are things like sounds, patterns, shapes, and colors. So the law now allows for new representations to be made available to the registry. So this means that we can use generally available technology to represent a trademark and therefore to protect that trademark. So starting from 2017, in the EU, new technologies are now allowed when it comes to registering a trademark. So I think this is a great opportunity for brands to consider how to protect new trends and how to protect new elements that are increasingly important for the fashion brand. I think that there might be some confusing arising on, you know, different elements of IP rights according to the jurisdiction. So I would start by saying that IP generally is a fairly harmonized field of law compared to other sectors. However, there are some elements that brands should be considering when it comes to building a global strategy. So one of these elements is definitely the difference between first to use countries and first to file jurisdictions. So in certain countries, some unregistered marks might still be relevant and might still obtain some level of protection, mainly in terms of unfair competition and passing off. And these countries include the US, Canada, Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong, and India, for instance. So in these countries, the examination and opposition stages are quite complex and objections to registrations are more common. Whereas in first to file jurisdictions, the majority, which are in fact the majority of countries, in these cases, use before filing, it's irrelevant, and therefore it is easier to obtain registration at an early stage. And it is important to obtain registration quite early in the creation process. So it is still possible to attack a registration based on prior use, but this would definitely be more difficult and costly. So between those countries, I think it is important to mention the European Union, the UK, China, Japan, and also some of the countries in the Middle East. So I would say the majority of countries are first to file jurisdiction.
That also brings me to this, you know, idea of reputation developed in the market, especially when you have a creative director that might come in and want to use, you know, a word, symbol, logo, or even a color from an archive. So could you tell us, I mean, how might reputation also play into, you know, that new use?
Referring to past use by a brand and therefore using archives, it is quite important and it does help the legal assessment. There is one challenge when it comes to use the archive, which is important to keep in mind. And this challenge is that competitors might have used similar elements or might have developed some reputation in the market in the meantime. So the fact that there is prior use in the past does not guarantee prior rights or exclusive rights. And obviously, the fashion industry evolves quite quickly, and this is important to take into account that third parties might have acquired rights in the meantime. So what I would suggest is to take into consideration and conduct clearance searches and include those details from the house archive as part of the clearance search. I think this is probably the best advice that I could give.
A great aurore for the archive, no longer a dusty office in the back of a company, but perhaps more of a live living thing than anyone ever thought it was before. And that brings me also back to this idea of authenticity and especially trademark rights. You know, I mean, we think of trademark rights as indicative of source, as indicative of the producer, and therefore there is some overlap, especially, you know, in the way that academics might think about the relationship between authenticity and trademark rights. But, you know, how do you in practice think about that relationship? Is there any way that you specifically counsel your clients to maintain their brand's reputation on the market through the policing of their trademarks too?
Certainly there is a connection between brand reputation and authenticity. I do think that policing trademarks is an essential part of this process. And brands might need to prioritize where and when to take action according to their core markets and places of manufacture, for example. I think that it's important to mention sustainability, and this should be, and it already is, a major concern for many brands when it comes to counterfeits, especially because as product safety should now be weighed against increasing demand for sustainable practices, and therefore the practice of destroying goods might not be sustainable anymore. And of course, non-sustainable approaches might now result in negative PR and therefore might impact a brand reputation.
We've covered a lot already how archives might best be used by designers, including maybe in the early stage of their career. So I'd like to maybe, you know, jump ahead because you mentioned this point about sustainability. I mean, I've seen sometimes the way that archival authenticity, this idea of, oh, it comes from the archive, helps to communicate that maybe a brand is more sustainable and, you know, helps with messaging. You know, in your experience, have you seen an archive make a difference for a brand on the market and by extension for a brand's IP rights?
Archives can be a useful source of inspiration for new collections, and use of archived pieces normally pose a lower risk of infringement, which is good news, and also a better option for brands to build their identity and reputation by referring to the historical elements with a modern interpretation. So I do agree. Archives can also inspire marketing campaigns and provide context when it comes to use higher risk names or higher risk designs. So archives can assist the legal department in risk assessment process. And I would say that it is important to make sure that archives are part of the internal conversation, especially before launching new collections.
I mean, how can lawyers work with fashion brands to think about and conceptualize authenticity? But also, you know, what are the future opportunities and challenges for fashion archives too, in your, you know, in your experience? Maybe what would you like to see as a as an IP attorney, in terms of access to an archive too?
Well, I would say that using archives as a source of inspiration can reduce the infringement risk, as well as having archives that can keep track of the creative process, and therefore including sketches, dates of creations, source of inspiration, can be material to establish prior rights and also build a brand identity and establish reputation in the market.
Yeah. And do you think that there are also opportunities for, you know, as fashion goes digital? I mean, for example, of having an increase opportunity for fashion archives?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that with the fashion world going digital, it is important to make sure that archives go digital as well. And it is important that everyone in the team, especially legal team and design team, can access that digital resource. And it is important to make sure that it is easy to search, it is user-friendly to search. And as you said before, it shouldn't be physical access only, it should be digital access. And for example, in the EU, we know that use of a certain brand should be shown in a number of countries, and it can be all member states or at least a great majority of member states. So gathering that type of evidence last minute is very difficult. Whereas if there is an updated record, if there is an archive to access to, this can provide a great tool to defend a case, and it can definitely make the difference between winning or losing a case.
As a final takeaway for the, you know, early career designers who may be listening in, the lawyers too, who have a client who's come to them and said, I have a fashion archive, you know, how do I think about this? How would you suggest that lawyers see the benefits and challenges of an archive in IP terms? You know, I think of lawyers, for example, who work in the IP space, but maybe aren't as familiar with even a brand having an archive, and they might be familiar with the concepts of trademark use and distinctiveness and secondary meaning. But how would you encourage lawyers to, or outline how they can map the concepts of distinctiveness and secondary meaning onto what may be in a brand or a designer's archive? And this is our last takeaway for our listeners.
Well, I would say that it is important to use archives as a resource, especially when it comes to IP law. And it is important to use those resources as much as possible in terms of making sure that we have updated records when it comes to using sources of inspiration, which are internal. And having updated records can facilitate the registrability of a brand as well as its enforcement. So as IP lawyers, I think it's important to use archives as evidence and use archives as part of our updated records. So it should be a teamwork, and it is important to involve legal consultants at the early stage of product development so that more practical suggestions can be made and can be provided to the brand. So it is very much a teamwork. And the final goal is to minimize risks with commercially minded suggestions, I would say. And in terms of things to keep an eye on, I would say that it is important to consider that there is an increasing level of sophistication, and therefore competitors might be developing new tools, including AI-driven tools. And it is important to consider, as part of this development, the challenges and the opportunities that the AI might bring, including what role AI might play in the creative process, and also what type of untested legal issues this might face. So I think it is one of those spaces to monitor and watch closely, and so that brands can be assisted in how to navigate these new challenges and opportunities with the right tools.
From my conversations with Sarah and Serena, the short answer to does archival authenticity matter is yes. For a nascent American luxury brand in New York City, an archive helps the brand keep track of its fabrics and silhouettes, and this buttresses the brand's consistency and allows it to even innovate. Consistency helps the brand communicate with its clients and build its brand identity. That strong brand identity can then match with other brands through collabs. I loved the story of how May's clients see the zebras on the Scalamandre print and are immediately attracted to May's messaging, finding a community in the brand. And from a legal perspective, archives provide important evidence for brands seeking to register designs, words, symbols, in other words, what you might think of as logos, as trademarks. An archive can provide examples of prior use and can even, if a brand has preserved past advertisements and more corporate ephemera, potentially be evidence of secondary meaning for marks that need it. An archive can show that an advertising campaign was so pervasive and successful that consumers and more stakeholders, including third-party media outlets, Hello, Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, etc., might now associate their brand with a design, word, or symbol, recognizing that design, word, or symbol as signaling the origin of the good on which that design, word, or symbol appears. And the goodwill in a trademark and that trademark's messages of quality and the brand's reputation can be placeholders for consumers' recognition and identification of a product as authentic. So archival authenticity can matter under the law too. But this is just part one of a three-part conversation about archival authenticity that I'm having at this proverbial fashion law dinner party. Stay with me for part two when I talk to Stefania Ricci from the Museo Ferragamo about the Ferragamo archive, and the fashion historian and theorist Matteo Gello, who has written a book on the history of curating Italian fashion and the role that archives play for Italian businesses.